Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colin Quinn. We'll start with the region's news. North Korea launched four short-range missiles into the sea off its west coast on Friday. South Korean military officials said the test appeared to have been personally supervised by Kim Jong-un. The tests come as annual exercises between Korea and US forces called Operation Full Eagle continue. The DPRK has launched 13 total missiles of different variants since the drills began in March. Myanmar's President Thein Sein witnessed the signing of a draft ceasefire between the government and representatives of the Nationwide Ceasefire Coordination Team, an alliance of 16 ethnic armed groups. The United Nations envoy to Myanmar hailed the agreement as historic and represents the first step in the complex peacemaking process in Myanmar, home to some of the world's longest-running civil wars, dating as far back as six decades. The Chinese Foreign Ministry publicly criticized the United States after US fighter aircraft landed in Taiwan on April 1st. Two US F-18s landed at an airbase in the southern city of Tainan after one reported mechanical problems. While the US supports Taiwan with arms sales as part of the Taiwan Relations Act, contact between the two militaries is rare due to Washington's One China policy. In regional economic news, Prime Minister Narendra Modi on April 2nd said India's banks should aim to deliver financial services to all households in the country by 2035. He particularly emphasized lending to the underprivileged and impoverished. While speaking at a financial inclusion conference organized as part of the 80th anniversary celebrations for the founding of the Reserve Bank of India, Modi challenged the banking sector to provide a roadmap to succeed. And that's the news. Now we turn to the status of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP. I sat down with CSIS Shoal Chair for International Business, Scott Miller, to understand where TPP stands and discuss some of the problems around this trade agreement. So, Scott, I want to ask you, what is the state of the TPP negotiations as they stand right now?
Well, here we are, April 1st, 2015, and for about the past year, progress on the negotiations has been, I'd characterize, slow but steady. A lot of progress made up until about March or April of 2014, and at that point, partly because of the United States not having its political house in order in terms of being able to conclude the agreement, things slowed down markedly. However, we're now to the point where, first, a lot of progress has been made. Second, every economy who's negotiating in this agreement has some sensitivities remaining. But importantly, every partner knows everybody else's sensitivities at this point. So it comes down to a matter of the sort of the most delicate issues, and those tend to be taken at the highest level of governments. Ministers are supposed to meet again in May, so this will continue. But I think the most important action here will happen in Washington with the Trade Promotion Authority, where the U.S. government will sort of sort through its issues, and the Congress and the President will be in a position to speak with one voice. At that point, I think you can see your way clear to a conclusion.
Are you optimistic that this Trade Promotion Authority will get passed now with this Republican Congress and obviously Democratic White House?
Well, I tend to view it the glass as half full, which I tend to. First, trade and specifically Trade Promotion Authority continues to be identified by the leaders of the Congress and by the President as an area of political cooperation. That's good news. It may, frankly, be the only area of political cooperation in 2015, but it is one, and it's an important one. So that's the first point. Second, I think that the turning point will come as the President does his job. And the President's job, as I've identified in a number of things I've written, is the President has to manage the very difficult party politics of trade for the Democratic Party. To the extent the President successfully manages the Democratic Party politics on trade, the Republicans leading in the House and Senate will be in a position to take care of business. Now, my sense is we'll get a read on this as early as April 13th. So 2 weeks from Monday, the Congress returns from its Easter recess. At that point, Senator Hatch will either have an agreement with Senator Wyden and be ready to introduce a Trade Promotion Authority bill, or he won't. But we'll get a sense soon after they're back whether this thing is going to move in the spring or if we have deeper problems.
So you talked about the sticking points the Republicans and Democrats have. Could you talk us through some of those?
Well, sure. I think there are some things that have been resolved. Chairman Hatch of the Senate Finance Committee and Chairman Ryan of the House Ways and Means Committee have done an awful lot of work behind the scenes and are pretty well calibrated. The second important decision that's been made is the strategy that the Senate go first. And given the current arithmetic on Capitol Hill, you have very large Republican majority in the House, and the House is sort of a majoritarian body. So in the House, if you have 218 votes, you can make anything happen that you really want, but you got to have 218. In the Senate, because of our supermajority or the 60 votes required, and the fact that the Senator McConnell's Republican majority has 54 seats, naturally the Senate will be the place that the bipartisan deal gets made. In other words, that's where a compromise will be crafted between Republicans and Democrats. I would expect a bill reported out of the Senate Finance Committee to attract roughly 50 Senate Republicans and roughly 15 Senate Democrats. That's a rough proportion of what happened in 2002. That's probably a winning hand, but it does take members of both parties. Once that bipartisan compromise is crafted in the Senate, the House can follow fairly quickly. And regardless of the preponderance of votes, Republican versus Democrat in the House will be prepared to move what's probably a fairly similar bill.
And I want to talk about one of the main sticking points that's been coming up recently, which is this idea of investor-state dispute settlement, ISDS. The headlines, you know, that corporations will be able to sue governments and basically impose on national sovereign countries' laws as a result of the TPP agreements. Could you try and clear up some of that for us?
It's been a rolling set of controversies. We've actually, things about currency manipulation have kind of quieted down, which is maybe good news. But with regard to investor state dispute settlement, there is currently what I would characterize as a lot of manufactured controversy on the subject. In Washington, we were treated to the spectacle of Senator Elizabeth Warren penning an op-ed in the Washington Post criticizing investment policy. And within a week, both the White House and the Washington Post editorial page had criticized Senator Warren back. So it's been kind of fun. At the core of the debate, many of the opponents of this characterize this policy, which basically it's treaty-based arbitration, and the in the event of a treaty breach, an investor who believes there's been a treaty breach can enter into arbitration with the government that breached the treaty and go to a private arbitration panel, usually managed at a place like the World Bank's facility, and recover either the damage that their investment sustained in the form of restitution of property or compensation for the harm created by the treaty breach. Most of us who study this carefully view this as a shield for investors. It is a protection against investment policy is generally a protection against arbitrary or discriminatory actions by governments in the course of an investor's experience. The opponents tend to characterize this as a sword, as some technique for big businesses to go after governments to as they would say sue them. As if it were a lawsuit for certain regulations they don't like. When you get underneath it, as my program has done recently, what you find is that there are express limits on the kinds of claims that can be brought. And in fact, bona fide regulation done in the public interest and administered fairly is by definition not a cause of action in these suits.
And through your research, is there like a typical example of one of these cases that you've maybe researched in the past that would kind of put this in a more understandable light for us?
Sure. Well, usually it starts with an investor who is operating in a foreign economy, and the government takes an action that is typically arbitrary, but often discriminatory. In other words, they treat that investor differently than they would treat a home country investor, or differently than the previous expectations. So usually there's a breach of a contract. In many of the energy cases, there is a concession agreement entered into, and the government breaches the concession agreement. Same thing that often happens in things like public utilities, where there's a big involvement of the state sector. Usually what happens is the contract goes bad, the government reneges on some portion of the contract. That's typically what gives rise to these disputes. So a famous case, small business, waste processing business in northeastern Ohio, called S.D. Myers, operated a facility in Canada to process a solid waste, polychlorinated biphenyls. And the Environment Ministry in Canada got wind of this, and in fact, the Environment Minister herself, a woman named Sheila Copps, stood up in the House of Parliament and stated on the public record that these are things that should be done by Canadians. Those are jobs being done by Canadians in Canada, which is a prima facie case of discrimination against an American firm. And so on national treatment grounds, S.D. Myers filed a claim, an arbitration claim, against the government of Canada. Canada later settled the case and admitted that they had done the wrong thing and allowed S.D. Myers to get back in business. But that's typically the circumstance in which these things happen. Now, what we've found is of all the cases that are filed, about a third of them are settled by the parties. But if you go all the way to an arbitral decision, governments win almost 65% of the time. So these are very difficult for the investor to win. And indeed, if the investor does prevail under those relatively difficult odds, that the awards granted by the arbitrators tend to be pennies on the dollar.
So back to this idea of even passing TPP and this trade promotion authority that's needed, I guess all eyes will be on April now to see if something can be done. Is there any timeline after this where it's all just looking at this date?
Well, our process is slow by design. It was never intended to be efficient, and it certainly couldn't be accused of efficiency. I always point out to people that in 2001, 2002, the last time the Congress granted the President trade promotion authority, the whole process from introduction of the bill to signing ceremony was actually 10 months. So it can take some time, but my sense is that Senator Hatch is prepared, Chairman Hatch is prepared to move, that Senator McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, has dedicated floor time. That's probably the key element. It'll probably take about 3 weeks on the Senate floor. So my guess is by the end of May, we're going to know whether this is going to happen or not. And I'm hoping for good news. And I do believe that the President and the leaders in Congress are quite serious about making it happen. And no doubt they understand the stakes of the U.S. as a leader in foreign policy, and particularly with regard to the Asia-Pacific agreement, TPP.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes on it. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Scott Miller. Now we turn to a crucial topic for both policymakers and business leaders worldwide, understanding China's vast economy. CSS Simon Chair Matt Goodman joined me to provide the details of his team's two-year effort to make sense of China's economic policymaking and what the United States and businesses should take away from his findings. Matt, I want to talk to you about your latest study on the Chinese economy. Now it seems it's never more timely because of this news about Chinese slowdown in their economy. Were you expecting that when you embarked on this study?
Well, we started the study in early 2013 when the new administration of Xi Jinping came into China. And we were really inspired by the fact that it was clear China had hit some kind of wall. It had reached the limits of its rapid growth, and it was clearly starting a transition in its economy. And so we were very interested in understanding what were the causes of that and what were the kind of institutional dynamics, the agencies of government, other agencies and stakeholders who were involved in economic affairs, and what was their role in helping shape a response to this changing economic circumstance. So we were very interested in understanding, getting behind the curtain in China and understanding how economic decisions are made in a changing economic environment.
And you talked a little bit about the institutions, but obviously very important to this is Xi Jinping and his impact. How much did you see that impacting their economic future?
Well, I wish we could say we were so clear-sighted that we knew that Xi would move so fast to consolidate power and set up his own new institutions like this party body that has got a very complicated long name, the Comprehensively Deepening Economic Reform Study Leading Small Group. And that he would put himself in charge of that. That's very unusual. In the past, the premier, in this case Li Keqiang, would have been expected to run that sort of a body. It would have been done more through the government, the state council, as it's called in China, rather than through the party. But so this consolidation by Xi was, I think, unexpected by most China observers, at least the speed with which it was done. And so I can't pretend that we saw that coming. And it certainly made for a more interesting look at China's evolving decision-making in this area.
And how do you see China evolving as they move from this rapid growth to this more slower, middle-income style economy? What are they going to have to do within their Communist Party system to move things forward?
Well, the really good thing about China is they recognize they've got a big problem. Not all governments acknowledge that. As they say, is a joke about alcoholics, the first step to recovery is acknowledging you have a problem. And the authorities there really understand that they have a problem. And so they are, they have themselves identified the big move that they need to make from an economic model that was based for 30 years on heavy investment, exports, and a single focus on increasing growth, and that performed that produced enormous economic growth, double-digit growth for 30 years, that they have to shift to a new model of growth that's based much more on domestic demand, which is a fancy way of saying consumption and the ability of ordinary Chinese to really spend more and drive the economy rather than depending on investment and exports. And based more on services rather than manufacturing. And that's a shift that they know they have to make, and they've set out a big reform plan to try to achieve that at their so-called third plenum in the fall of 2013. And now they're in the implementation phase, and that's much more challenging. But they at least recognize they have a problem. They've laid out a good plan, and they're trying to make this shift to a consumption services-led model of growth.
And of course, the study's title was Navigating the Choppy Waters. Did you find at the end that China is equipped to do this? What did you find at the end of it?
Right. Well, we have this image of the sort of boat going down the Yangtze River, and they're now in the rapids, and they're the guys on the back of the boat trying to keep this thing stable and upright. And, you know, so far, the track record of Chinese economic decision makers has been very strong. I mean, since Deng Xiaoping opened up the economy in 1979, you know, as I say, it's produced tremendous economic success. The circumstances now are different. The economic challenges are much greater. And there are other challenges that are related, like the environmental problems and a demand for greater equality, greater fairness in government, not necessarily for democracy, but for greater equality and fairness in government. All of these demands are coming at once. And against that backdrop, it's going to require a special and a new set of skills. I would say on balance, and we conclude this in a report, that we think that they do have the right stuff, as it were, to manage this transition. I think that's not a certainty, but I think that's the likely direction because they've shown such great flexibility and pragmatism in the past. They do have a lot of tools. They have incentives. They have a lot of money. So there are a lot of things going in their favor as they're tackling this. But it's not an absolute certainty, and I think that definitely the order of magnitude of the challenges is greater than anything they've had to deal with before.
And we talked about Xi Jinping having very tight stewardship of the Chinese economy. He's obviously going very far forward with this anti-corruption campaign. How is that going to affect the Chinese leadership and the Chinese economic movement from now forward?
Well, you can look at that as a part of, as a means to trying to achieve the kind of economic reform they need, because they do need to improve governance in China. They need to have more of a basis of rule of law or rule by law, as many people have pointed out in China, but a greater certainty about the economic foundations as a precondition for launching reform. And so this anti-corruption drive can be seen as a way of cleaning up the system and preparing for the kinds of real reforms that are going to cut into some of the traditional vested interests in China. That's the sort of happy or positive way of looking at this. On the other hand, this anti-corruption campaign has been so pervasive, so broad, so sustained, that there is a concern that it's really chilling initiative in China, and that a lot of people, decision makers, particularly at the local level, who have been the agents of the economic success, but have also been the big beneficiaries by, we say in fancy terms in economics, through rent seeking behavior, meaning skimming off a little off the top for themselves. So this is being cracked down on, and the question is that going to chill sort of any actions by these people at the local level, because they're going to be worried that attention could be drawn to them and they could get in trouble. And so, without them bought in and incentivized to really implement some of these reforms, it could be more challenging. And it does seem there's evidence that local level implementation is slowing down as a result of this anti-corruption campaign. So it's a worry. And we'll see how it plays out.
And of course, China's economic success is tied to the U.S. economic success in a lot of ways. Is there anything that came out of this that would lead you towards some recommendations for how the U.S. should be approaching China and, of course, Asia as a whole?
Well, the direction of China's economy is absolutely critical to the United States. It's now China's the second largest economy in the world, and we need China to succeed and grow for our own economic success. And so we do have a huge stake in this. And so in our report, we try to look at what that stake is and provide some thoughts and recommendations to the U.S. government about how they should respond and deal and encourage China to move on this track towards a more consumption-led model of growth. And some specific ideas we've offered about how to organize the U.S. government to do this. Things like having a robust engagement strategy directly with China and in the broader region to try to incentivize China to move in this direction. So we have a dozen recommendations in the report that we think are actionable and would help improve the approach. The broad conclusion we make is that China is not like any other country. It's much bigger. It's much more important than any other economic relationship we have, and we have to be a lot more focused on China and finding the time, the policy space to really work on trying to encourage the right kind of economic direction in China. And so that's the main recommendation, is that we kind of mobilize an all-out effort to try to work on Chinese economic policy.
Okay, well, Matt Goodman.
Okay.
We'll take a look at that. Thanks for joining us. And that was Matt Goodman. Finally now to our one to watch. India's iconic auto rickshaws may be serving Uber soon. The San Francisco-based car service Uber has reportedly begun the process of launching an auto rickshaw service in India in an effort to shed its perception as a premium service. Uber has begun market testing the rickshaw service in Delhi. Like elsewhere in Asia, the company faces pressure from traditional taxi services as well as app-based competitors, including the Indian-based network Ola, which operates large on-demand auto rickshaw services in several major Indian cities. In December 2014, the Delhi government cancelled the licenses of Ola and Uber following the alleged rape of a passenger by the driver of an Uber network taxi. Despite the ban, both services have continued to operate in the city. Balancing between its image as a global luxury car service and inexpensive local competitor represents one of Uber's key struggles as it attempts to break into Asia and other lower-income markets worldwide, particularly in regions where credit card usage remains extremely low, such as Southeast Asia, or in places where existing car services are innovating. Whether the company will be able to succeed for the long term in challenging markets such as China, Japan, and South Korea will likely depend on its flexibility. Providing auto rickshaw services in India appears to be a first step in trying to innovate while still offering local appeal. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.